Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update from Egypt after a bloody day of street battles in which either 150 or more than 2,000 died, depending upon whether you believe the military or the Muslim Brotherhood, who were forcibly removed from their encampments. Jawad Nabulsi, one of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution 2 years ago, joins us from Cairo, which is under curfew, to discuss a polarized country where there will either be a restoration of democracy or a civil war. Then we will speak with Adam Klasfeld, a reporter for Courthouse News who has been covering the Bradley Manning trial from the beginning. We will discuss testimony by Bradley Manning, who is facing 90 years in military prison, delivered in an unsworn statement that appeared to contradict much of what his defense has been arguing, in which Bradley Manning apologized, saying, "I'm sorry my actions hurt people, and I'm sorry that it hurt the United States." Then finally, we will look into the sentencing of ex-Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. in Washington, D.C. for a lavish spending spree of $750,000 in campaign funds and the sentencing of his wife, who will serve her prison term after his, who pleaded guilty for not reporting $600,000 in taxable income. Catherine Skiba, an award-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune, who has been covering the trial, joins us to discuss the crimes and punishment of this once promising elected official. And joining us now from Cairo is Jawad Nabulsi, who is one of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution 2 years ago, during which he created the first medical treatment center for those wounded in the revolution. He himself was shot and is blind in one eye. A businessman turned community organizer, he has since been working to make sure the revolution benefits the poor. Jawad founded the Nebni Foundation, which tries to empower young people to participate in shaping Egypt's economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jawad Nabulsi.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I take it because of the curfew, you're stuck at home. And I take it the streets are deserted now. Is that true?
Not completely deserted. Egyptians tend to always obey the curfew. We usually are called that we are the only ones who go and watch a curfew in the streets. We're known for that. So, no, they're not completely empty. But I tend to now try to follow the curfew because things are not as safe as before.
Well, it's been an extremely violent day, and there's a great disparity between the official government figures that 149 people were killed in the police and military operation to remove the Muslim Brotherhood protesters from their encampments. The Muslim Brotherhood are saying that over 2,000 people died. What's your understanding of what happened and what the casualties are?
I mean, we have, the past, 2 years throughout this violence. Use of force by the obsessive use of force by the police and the military is that there is a lot of casualties. And for me, one blood of Egyptian is enough. So it doesn't matter for me if it's 10 or 2,000. For me, we were against the Muslim Brotherhood all the way. And the Muslim Brotherhood stood with the police and the army against us at different times. And even so, my principles are the same, is that this way of removing these protesters, even though they were not all peaceful, to be honest, it could have been done with much less casualty or on a much better political solution than it was done right now. And for that position that I'm taking, and a lot of the revolutionaries are taking, we are considered the black sheep right now. By everyone, by the Muslim Brotherhood, by many of the Egyptian citizens who supported the military. So for me, to be honest, I don't know what the numbers are. Everyone's media outlet is getting their own numbers. But at the end of the day, you have blood. And we have learned that blood is not the way to solve any problem.
Well, I take it that your views, Jawad Nabulsi, are similar to those of Muhammad al-Baradei, who resigned because he advocated exactly what you said, apparently, within the government. He urged them not to use brute force, and they overruled him, and he was forced to resign. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And I want to tell you something. I mean, and I did talk to several people, in the police, and I told them, if you just look at the numbers of protesters in the morning, and you look at the numbers from the beginning to what's happening, they're decreasing. And if you have just let them, and I know personally Muslim Brotherhood supporters who used to go every day to the square, and in last weekend we were at the North Coast in the beach, and I saw them there, and people were starting to kind of mentally give up. But what they did right now, and using this blood, is actually what I believe is what the Muslim Brotherhood really wanted. Now they will gain the support again, and blood will bring violence, and it's going to just keep the circle of violence to keep going. And my understanding is, Mr. Brother, to answer your question, yes, we are on the same line. And a lot of us, and which we are not the majority, we are the very minimal minority who think that way, is that we believe that there could have been a different solution than having people killed.
So, in other words, just to summarize what you've told us, Jawad Nabulsi, the encampment of protesters, they were beginning to lose heart, and it would have been wiser for the government, and this is apparently what Mohamed El Baradei counseled, just to let it sort of peter out. And now this brute force has in fact made martyrs out of the Muslim Brotherhood, increased their popularity, or even worse, driven them underground. So what's your analysis of that?
I mean, you summed it perfectly. I mean, if you look at a lot of the violent Islamic movements, I mean, they started mainly after Abdel Nasser oppression against the Muslim Brotherhood during his rule, and they rebelled against the Muslim Brotherhood leaders who were calling for non-violent opposition, and a lot of the jihadi, Jama'a Islamiyya, a lot of these were actually Muslim Brotherhood, and they did not obey the Muslim Brotherhood leaders. So what's worrisome right now is that you are pushing their young people towards that kind of solution, is that they are going to really give up on what's so-called democracy, give up on elections, and give up on everything that peaceful that they thought might get them what they want, because now they feel they're threatened and they will be prosecuted. So the only way to turn is violence, and this is a really scary situation that that's really worrisome, and you're right. I mean, and working on the ground, that's the last thing we want, and especially not even working on the ground peacefully, but working on the ground violently. So I really don't know where we're going right now with what's happening.
So what's the sense then of what will happen on Friday with Friday prayers? Do you think the curfew and the military threat to suppress any demonstrations will be sufficient to keep people at home, or do you think they'll respond on Friday and take to the streets, the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think now they will be starting to try to arrest the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood and the ones who are focal in terms of organizing protesters. I think that's the next move that's going to happen. I don't think the MB and their supporters are going to give up easily. And I think we will see more violence. And in return, you will see state police also going back and using violence again. And what's also on a personal level, what the messages we are getting is that we are next.
You mean the liberals are next? The liberals are.
I'm saying the revolutionaries. The revolutionaries who are really because my stance right now is not. It's not what the people want to hear right now. And Baradei, if you even watch the state media, now what they're saying about the Baradei now is calling him a traitor, he's a U.S., puppy and all that stuff. So we believe that, the voice that we're calling for, is going to really, we're going to pay heavily for it because the majority of the population is not on our side. I think the more violence happens, the more people become radical. So whenever you say your sense and you try to talk rational with people who are emotionally driven on both sides, you are treated as, you know, as they call us now, we are traitors and we are and we sold our country and so on and so forth.
So give us a sense then, Jawad Nabulsi, you as a member of the, as a revolutionary from the original revolution, not to want to label you, but on the liberal secular side, you say that you're in the minority, the majority of the people. Give us a sense of who supports the military and who supports the Brotherhood that's left in the political. You've been marginalized by these events. So now what's the breakdown, if you could, between those that support the military and those that support the Brotherhood?
So we say if we start, like, you know, during the first revolution, so we were a big mix, right? So young people on all different ideologies going down the streets and, you know, having one big enemy, which is Mubarak regime. And this regime fell down. During that time, you have the majority of the Egyptian population. By the way, we're not in the streets. The majority of Egyptians were just sitting and watching the revolution on TV. And these people were just, you know, following the media and what the media are saying. And these people have not been active, you know, and on most of the fronts, they've not been active, they're just watching. So as time progressed and the Muslim Brotherhood started getting into power and getting more organized, a lot of the Islamic MB young people who were with us, they started to alienate themselves from us and started following more their leaders and the way they thought, and, you know, they started even becoming more radical in their thoughts. They weren't really coming and talking sense with us, even if their leaders were doing something wrong, like in Mohammed Mahmoud, in which the police were shooting at us. And you still have we call it the couch party, that's just sitting and watching. So right now you have the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist Jama'a Islamiyah front, and then you have the couch party. And for the first time, really, they went down to the streets in June 30th. And these people, this action, what's happening, is new to them. But what's really scary is that they don't really understand the situation, from my perspective, and they are also choosing radical solutions. So they would say, let's clear and kill all of the Muslim Brotherhood in the street. And we say, of course, that's not. And we would say, no, that's not right. Then they say, oh, so you're Muslim Brotherhood. I'm like, no, I'm not Muslim Brotherhood. But I'm saying there is a different solution than killing. So to answer your questions, I think there are three fronts. There are the Islamists, MB, and their supporters, and you have the couch party, let's call it like that, that is also on the other front. And then you have a very, very, very small minority who kind of try to go with the same values that we called for during the first revolution, which is a nonviolence, freedom, justice, and equality. So this is, you know, this is my categorization of what I can see.
So from the point of view of the United States, a lot of people in the United States are appalled, and they were very uncomfortable about the coup in the first place, a military coup, which tried to pretend at the time that it was a part of the Temerod movement, and that appears from what you just told us to have splintered. But there is, I think, a lot of pressure from the left in the United States on Obama to cut ties with the Egyptian military and to stop subsidizing them to a tune of $1.5 billion a year. What would be the response of that, do you think? And I'm not sure it's likely to happen, because I'm sure the military, Pentagon people and the State Department people and the intelligence people are probably all advising Obama not to cut ties with General Sisi. But what would your sense be? Because my understanding is the average Egyptian thinks the Americans are responsible for the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that true?
I mean, you can't say average Egyptian, so because, right, you know, you have, yeah, I mean, the average Egyptian is a very now wide description.
Right.
So But, you know, in the matter of the military aid, I mean, you know, when I was in the States and I really started looking into the military aid and started to understand and talking to different people, I mean, the U.S. is really benefiting a lot from the military aid. I mean, all the factories and the workers that are working and the economies that are thriving because of this military aid, a lot of it are all the jobs that are created are in the United States. And these people have senators and congressmen representatives in their states. So, and these senators and congressmen don't want to see thousands of jobs getting laid off because of the military aid. So I think if the U.S. really had that much power, they would have used it during last year. If you remember, when they kicked out the NGOs, you remember, out of Egypt, and the military was in power actually, not the Muslim Brotherhood. So if the U.S. really had that much influence, you know, they would have kind of prevented the military from kicking out all the NGOs out of Egypt. But I don't think, and the Egyptian army is very smart, they know the U.S. cannot and don't want to actually give up the military aid because of their own personal interests. And so I think this issue of military aid and threatening with it, it's not really, it won't happen, and it's not really something that, you know, it's just the media uses every now and then to show that the U.S. has some kind of influence over the military in Egypt. And it's a mutual interest and mutual benefit, and the U.S. would never do it.
Well, of course, the military aid comes out of the Camp David Accords, where the United States, in order to bring about the peace between Israel and Egypt and the demilitarization of the Sinai, pledged this military aid to both to Israel and to Egypt. And the assumption is, particularly from reading the Israeli press, that they're thrilled that the Muslim Brotherhood was overturned and they support the Egyptian military. So given that you just told us that there's no such thing anymore as the average Egyptian, what could you tell us then about how most Egyptians feel about the fact that the Israelis, who are not popular, from my understanding, support the military government in Egypt?
You know, that comes back also to the most Egyptians. What I see right now, that I can't speak for most Egyptians. I mean, politically, what happens is that if the U.S. And Israel support one side, this side is kind of this support is used against them. So when Israel came out and Ehud Barak's interview went and supported, spoke positively of Sisi, of course you had a lot of the MB, Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of the supporters against the military used that against them. And on the other side as well, when McCain came and spoke in kind of a little bit support of the Muslim Brotherhood, that was used against the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, I think for the normal Egyptian, things are really confusing, you know. So he's seeing a lot of politics, same sides supporting different sides. So I don't think, you know, things are as clear as, you know, that these are right, these are wrong. That's the reality. I mean, I don't want to give an unrealistic view, but this is how the people, things are not as clear for everyone. And if you're talking about the normal Egyptian, also things are really vague. And you know, if someone just looks at the media and sees all this, you know, a different call from like the U.S. to the Senate, State Department, to NGOs, to like Israeli military, and everyone supporting a different side, so no one can really say that this side is on that side or this side on that side.
And we didn't even mention Saudi Arabia, of course, the supporter of the Al-Nur, the Salafi party, and they apparently have been, they were the first to congratulate the military for taking over recently. So they're obviously active in the mix as well. So if you think the Egyptian people are confused, I guess the American people, who are much less political, they're completely lost. So
I think, you know, if people want to, like, if you actually want to send a message, I mean, we read different revolutions and we look at different figures around the world throughout history, Mandela, Gandhi, and we went down the revolution. We we had no personal interest. We were doing well financially, and our values are the same. And this is what I tell people: align your values with your interests. And if our values are calling for, you know, nonviolence and supporting democratic rule and supporting non-military, you know, this non-military rule and civic rule, and then that's what we should be lobbying for. What happens is, you know, you find governments like the U.S. government, are willing to compromise these values in which, you know, when I come to the States and I visit, like, Washington, and I see how, you know, how the States was based on, you know, equality and freedom and justice, and I see the actions are not really, you know, relevant to what your constitution or what the people were calling for. This is what really confuses us. I'm calling the Americans, if they want to know, they should go back to their values that they were built on their states and call for it and push for it very hard, and not to give in to what's so-called interests that are going to be good maybe for the short term, but on the long term, you will lose much greater support and much greater respect in which at certain points you did have.
Well, just in closing, Jawad Nabulsi, this latest crackdown by the military, where they've declared effectually martial law and a curfew for the next month, but they do say, as they said when they took over recently in the coup, which was not supposed to be a coup, but it's looking more and more like a coup, they have said that they want to restore democracy, for the want of a better description. Is there any chance in the world that the Muslim Brotherhood will re-enter the political system and run candidates? You know, I mean, it seems unlikely at this point, but the idea of them going underground and essentially having a civil war in Egypt is a terrible nightmare. So just in closing, leave us with a sense of what you think will happen in a month's time.
I think, the main front of, you know, battle is, number one, the Constitution. So the military can say whatever they want. The Muslim Brotherhood can say whatever they want, and both of them told us that they will have a constitution that is representative, that, you know, presents a civic state, and this has not happened. And what I'm looking for right now is people are not talking about the constitution. The constitution is being cooked, and this is what I am focusing on. A lot of us are focusing on. A lot of us are lobbying on is that to make sure that we have a constitution that we build on that will allow maybe the Muslim Brotherhood to come back in process, right? So based on this constitution and based on these foundations, then I can tell you with if in the long term or maybe in the short long term is that will the Muslim Brotherhood come back in process? Will they be prosecuted injustly? Will the justice system be modified in order for it to be much more fair? And will the police be changed and reorganized in which their ideology is mostly based on violence and oppression and, you know, and so on and so forth? So I can't predict really what's going to happen, but what I see right now, if we have a proper constitution, if we have proper pressure that this constitution comes out in a way that is acceptable, like all other nations that have been thriven, then I can say, yes, no one will be oppressed. No one will be prosecuted unjustly. But if this is cooked in a way that does not guarantee rights and does not channel down to laws through the elections, then, you know what I mean? I think it's going to turn to maybe a civil war. I really hate saying that. I've never thought I would ever say that. But yes, it does not look that pretty right now.
Well, Jawad Nabulsi, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jawad Nabulsi, who's one of the organizers of the Egyptian Revolution 2 years ago, during which he created the first medical treatment center for those wounded in the revolution. He himself was shot and is blind in one eye. A businessman turned community organizer, he has since been working to make sure the revolution benefits the poor. Jawad founded the Nebni Foundation, which tries to empower young people to participate in shaping Egypt's economy, and he joined us from Cairo. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Bradley Manning's testimony today in his sentencing trial. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adam Klasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Service. He has been covering the Bradley Manning trial from the beginning, and he just wrote the article, Manning Gives Contrite Statement as 90-Year Max Sentence Looms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Klasfeld.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, the testimony that Bradley Manning gave today, where he spoke for the first time, it wasn't sworn testimony. So what is the point of that? Is it because it cannot be cross-examined?
Well, 2 points of that. Yes, it's unsworn, so it's not subject to cross-examination. And another thing is, it's the first time that he's testified during the trial phase of his court-martial. Now, the court-martial has been going on for roughly 3 years. It started with an Article 32 hearing, which is the military equivalent of a grand jury, in December 2010. He actually has spoken since then in November when he was discussing his treatment at Quantico Prison when he was in an 8x6 cell for more than 23 hours a day. That was actually sworn testimony. He was subject to cross-examination at that time. He also delivered a statement in February, which was dramatically opposite to what we heard in Fort Meade today.
And what's your interpretation of why he appeared to be so contrite? I mean, he is facing, for all intents and purposes, a life sentence.
Oh, absolutely. It's hard to say. I can't really speak to what's going on in Bradley Manning's mind. I can say that he appeared nervous on the stand. As you mentioned, he could face 90 years in prison as a 25-year-old man. That's the rest of his life. It could be a calculation, or it could be he says in the statement that based on what he saw in the sentencing and the merits phase of trial, that he believed that he saw that the leaks hurt people and hurt the United States, which is interesting because seeing at it from someone who's seen the unclassified portion of the testimony, what reporters have seen is what reporters have reported, that the actual damage was much less than people had anticipated. What I can say is, for through the mind of an idealistic young man, there were things that I can't imagine that when coming to light he would have found troubling, that certain names that appeared in the files, there were people who had to be shuttled to safety, for example, that there was an operation in Afghanistan to warn people that their names had been exposed. But in terms of tracing a name being exposed, none of those names came into harm's way, according to the testimony. The Brigadier General who investigated these leaks, Brigadier General Robert Carr, said that he could not trace any of the leaks to a death. So it's difficult to say what's going through Manning's mind today and what he was referring to the great damage, because that damage didn't seem readily apparent in open court.
So in effect, you're suggesting, Adam Klasfeld, that Bradley Manning today contradicted the weight of his defense testimony? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's interesting. It's maybe almost contradicting what the open court testimony had shown. The defense's sentencing case, it seemed like today was at the same time very surprising, but not entirely unexpected. If you look at where the defense case has been from the beginning of sentencing, they have called attention to Manning's psychological state before in the merits phase, and in Manning's statement, they had mostly talked about the limited effect of the leaks, that they talked about Manning's idealism. Right now in the sentencing phase, there's a lot of conversation about his tough childhood. There's a lot of conversations about they're taking clinical psychologists and forensic psychologists who are talking about the effect that childhood had on his psyche. They seem to be backtracking on the position that the leaks had a very limited effect. Beyond that, I don't know if I can speculate as to why he did that, because, I can't really speak to Bradley Manning's psyche.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Adam Klasfeld, who's a reporter for Courthouse News Service. He has been covering the Bradley Manning trial from the beginning, and he just wrote an article at Courthouse News Service. Manning gives contrite statement as 90-year max sentence looms. Now, in saying he's sorry that he hurt the United States, he said that his only regret for his actions was that I should have worked more aggressively inside the system. So wasn't that one of the problems that he had, was that he tried to work inside the system and nobody was interested? I mean,
well, yeah, no, that was two highlights of the defense, that there was one incident that they spoke about where, and this, even when he was talking to Adrian Lemieux, the former hacker who turned him into the authorities, he mentioned this incident when he was in Iraq and he was given an order to find quote-unquote bad guys who he learned in his research and investigation were actually people distributing literature about financial corruption in the Maliki presidency. So he took that to a superior working within the system there and was told, no, let's find more bad guys, but according to these chat logs, according to testimony that we heard in court. So there was an instance there where he did try working within a system. But what he did in terms of the kind of mass disclosures, it's very hard to imagine a systemic approach to that he was basically leaking categories of data. I don't know any kind of systemic approach of saying expose the diplomatic cables, for example, 250 cables, to give people a more broad view of U.S. statecraft and diplomacy. That's something that can only be accomplished with a leak. So he, in that statement, I think he's distancing himself entirely from that action.
Well, but Adam Klasfeld, when you mentioned earlier about Bradley Manning being sorry for hurting the United States and the extent to which naming some people that had worked for the United States as informants, etc., in these State Department cables, I mean, the fact that he gave them wholesale to WikiLeaks without any redactions, that was the nature of the leak.
Yes.
But the real decision, my understanding, is that when the New York Times and The Guardian and El País and the other people that were handed these leaks by WikiLeaks, they were the ones that felt obliged to redact their names. And Julian Assange was furious with them. He wanted to go at it exactly as with 100% transparency. So I'm surprised that Bradley Manning is taking the fall here. Couldn't he have made the argument that, well, of course, he can't really make the argument that, because he didn't redact them, he gave him raw intelligence. But the person who really was insisting on not redacting the information was Assange, not him.
Mm. Well, I don't know if there's anything known about what step in the process, if any, Bradley Manning had in Assange's decision to redact or not redact certain things. At the time, Cablegate began as a more controls release, then for some reason that was disputed between Assange and The Guardian, all the entire 250,000 cable trove had been exposed. So it's
well, that's what happened. You know, when the New York Times and when The Guardian said we got to redact these names, Assange got mad and then released them unredacted to the world. That's what happened.
Yes. And that was, I can imagine, from Manning's point of view, when he's delivering the statement, I wanted to help people, not hurt people, he might have been talking about the testimony that came out about leaked names being shuttled to safety. We don't know the scale of that kind of operation. That wasn't revealed in open court. We do know that with the Afghanistan battlefield reports, which WikiLeaks released as war logs, those reports led to a 9-month operation to what is known as mitigation efforts to inform the people on the ground that their names had been exposed. And that number was in the thousands. So that was a large-scale operation, and that might have been what he was referring to at that time. He might have been saying in court that he didn't have a clear understanding that that would result in his youthful idealism.
So, Adam, given that you've been covering this trial from the beginning and today in the sentencing, which is going to happen next week, I believe, Bradley Manning did speak, albeit in unsworn testimony, where he said he's sorry for his actions, that I'm sorry my actions hurt people, I'm sorry that I hurt the United States, and that he should have worked more aggressively inside the system. I imagine that anybody is facing, is 25 years old and is facing 90 years in jail, or effectively the rest of their lives, they're going to, aren't they going to appeal for mercy? I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I mean, on one hand, it's very, of course he's going to be apologetic, of course he's going to seek mercy. The thing that I was noting in my article was how much of a dramatic reversal this marked when looking at his other unsworn statement, the one that he gave in February.
Well, that's true, but I guess his lawyers told him that he's not in good shape, right? I mean, isn't it pretty clear that this is a military court? He has violated military rules. So this is not a civilian court. Isn't it a foregone conclusion that whatever sentence he gets, it's going to be pretty severe?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's been known for a while, especially since the verdict, that his sentence was going to be severe.
Right.
Before, it used to be he was facing more than 136 years in prison. That potential sentence was reduced to 90 years only recently. And I think at best he could only expect a sentence of decades in prison. So I think, of course, it's quite natural that he is going to appear very apologetic today. I guess where I'm hesitating here is to definitively say, because I'm not in the mind of Bradley Manning, I can only see a young man on the witness stand appearing nervous and delivering statements that are markedly different than anything he said before.
And assuming that he's given a stiff sentence, which is very likely, maybe the judge may show some mercy and not throw the book at him with 90 years, but maybe even half of that is pretty draconian. Will he go to Leavenworth? I mean, they don't have any club feds in the military.
No, he is currently staying in Leavenworth. I don't know if he would remain in Leavenworth in the event of a sentence. I don't think that information has been revealed yet. But that's where he's staying now. When he was first arrested, he was in Baghdad and then sent to Kuwait, then to Quantico, and now, since that time, in Leavenworth.
Well, at the very least, they should be able to deduct the time that he's already served.
And that is actually, that's a pretty much a foregone conclusion. Plus, he has a deduction of time for the time he spent in Quantico. When I mentioned the Quantico hearing earlier, I don't know how much your listeners are aware of his stay in Quantico, but that was the time when he was spending more than 23 hours a day in an 8x6 cell, routinely monitored on suicide watch. The military judge ruled it unlawful pretrial punishment, and in that ruling, deducted over 100 days to what's sure to be a lengthy sentence. So there is going to be that deduction. There is likely to be a deduction for the time he served, but he still faces pretty hefty time.
Well, Adam Klasfeld, I thank you very much for joining us from the trial at Fort Meade. And we'll stay in touch, obviously, and find out what happens next week.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Adam Klasfeld, who's a reporter for Courthouse News Service. He has been covering the Bradley Manning trial from the beginning, and he just wrote an article at Courthouse News Service, Manning Gives Contrite Statement as 90-Year Max Sentence Looms. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife's sentencing today in Washington, D.C.
Good morning, world, your honor. The crown will plainly show the prisoner that now stands before you was caught red-handed showing feelings of an almost human nature. This will not do.
Here comes the judge! Here comes the judge!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Catherine Skiba, who's an award-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune. Previously, she was with the U.S. News & World Report and the Milwaukee Journal. She's the author of a memoir based on the Iraq invasion, Sister in a Band of Brothers, embedded with the 101st Airborne in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Skiba.
Thank you for having me on your program.
So tell me, you've been covering the Jesse Jackson trial, which of course was conducted in Washington, D.C., although he represented Chicago as a congressman. And the sentencing was today, and it seemed extraordinarily dramatic. Your piece is very alive with descriptions. And so give me a sense then of the contrition here, which of course is to be expected. But I guess with his father being present, and I take it that there was some compassion shown by the judge in as much as him and his wife are allowed to serve their sentences not concurrently, so that because they have young children, right, the 9-year-old and the 13-year-old.
Yes. Well, let's look at the fundamentals of the case. For starters, it's very rare in the criminal justice system to have his and her defendants' guilty pleas, which we had in February, and today back-to-back sentencing, and they lasted 4.5 hours in total. Now, the congressman, with his wife, they took roughly $750,000 in their campaign funds and frittered away this money in an astonishing way. A holistic retreat in Martha's Vineyard, a cruise on a Disney ship, memorabilia from Vegas like Michael Jackson's fedora, and then you go on and on, furs, appliances, children's furniture, restaurant meals. It's kind of a dizzying array, 3,100 separate transactions. In the end, the former congressman got 30 months behind bars. His wife got 1 year in prison. Now, it's important to note, as the prosecutors did, this was not an unknowing spouse. She was at various points his campaign treasurer, a very well-paid consultant to the campaign, and in 2012, his campaign manager. The judge, they did make a very tearful and poignant remark to the judge. That's any defendant's prerogative, and we were fully expecting them to speak because as elected officials, he, a congressman, and she for several years, an alderman in Chicago, you know, these are people who are familiar with the microphone and well-spoken and intelligent and educated. So try as they may, Mrs. Jackson very desperately wanted to be put on probation. And after not reporting $600,000 in income taxes, that was really never going to be in the cards. Congressman Jackson got a break in the sense that the government wanted him behind bars for 4 years, and he came up with a 2.5-year sentence. He'll get about 15% credit if he behaves well behind bars. And both of them also should get, toward the very end of their term, some home detention or halfway house confinement.
And, of course, just to add to the loot that you've written about in your article in the Chicago Tribune, both Jacksons get prison terms. He'll serve, Catherine Skiba. There was also a $43,000 Rolex watch and a guitar that belonged to Eddie Van Halen. But isn't this whole thing is also, I mean, the trial itself surely goes back to the critical period under Blagojevich when the choice for the who would succeed who would accede to the United States Senate or at least get to run for the very symbolic seat of Barack Obama. Isn't that where this whole train wreck began?
Well, no, in a word. Let me say there was no trial because they pled guilty, they cooperated with the investigation, and today was the sentencing. So they got credit, actually, for sparing the government the burden of two trials, which, sometimes trials can be a roll of the dice. So the prosecutors in February at the time of the guilty pleas knew that they had gotten them on substantial felony violations. And a story I'm preparing for tomorrow, Chicago Tribune, quotes the lead prosecutor with something he's told me before. He said this to me in February. The Blagojevich case, now this is Rod Blagojevich, the Illinois governor who wanted to sell or trade Barack Obama's open Senate seat. This is late 08 after Obama has won the White House. The allegations were that emissaries for Jackson offered Blagojevich up to $6 million in campaign cash that Jackson was to have raised for Blagojevich to be appointed to the Senate. And the suspicion long had been with this very aggressive prosecution of Blagojevich and his cronies that somehow at that time Jackson fell under scrutiny. Now, that's not what Ron Machen, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, says. And he's very careful about sources and methods, but he also says that there was a long paper trail. I mean, most of this was credit card transactions. It was kind of mind-boggling that people would be so foolish. So it was a long paper trail, and I know the government has all sorts of traps out there for credit card fraud and credit card abuse and financial misconduct. And my own opinion is that's perhaps how Jackson got tripped up.
So he wouldn't. Do you think that given that he was a sort of front runner, in a sense, to the open seat following President Obama's election? That did the White House do any checking on him? I mean, if he was so flagrant in embezzling his own campaign funds, would they have how much do you think they considered him? And if so, would they have done a background check?
Okay, so let me point out that the way the election law works in Illinois, when that seat came open in late 08, because of Barack Obama is no longer in the Senate, he's president elect. It fell solely to the Illinois governor to appoint a replacement. And I don't know that Jackson was a front runner per se. He had served in the House for many years. He wanted the seat very desperately. Let's remember that being the son of Reverend Jackson, who ran twice for president with some success, didn't win, but he had a very formidable campaign. You know, all eyes were on Congressman Jackson for many, many years, and people thought he might be the first black president. And frankly, it's come out that he felt jealous and jealous about Barack Obama's, you know, huge, quick rise in Illinois politics to the U.S. Senate and to the White House. So it did fall only to Blagojevich, and we ended up getting Roland Burris for over a year in that seat, not Jesse Jackson Jr.
Well, indeed, and that cost the Democrats. So, I mean, clearly you're correcting me here, which I need to be corrected, because I have a kind of just the memory of what was going on there. And in terms of I recall, though, that Jackson appeared to be kind of auditioning, and weren't there some telephone intercepts as well? Where he was really basically pitching himself. So my memory of that period was pretty much that Blagojevich sort of screwed the Democrats, didn't he? That they lost that seat after Burris.
Yes, they did. They lost it in 2010, and people were very, you know, Roland Burris had his own baggage and was not considered the most formidable pick for that job. And in 2010, that seat fell to Senator Mark Kirk, who currently serves. He's a Republican from Illinois. And, you know, I will apologize. I didn't cover the Blagojevich case on a day-to-day basis, so I can't tell you what was on the intercepts. I can tell you Jesse Jackson testified at Blagojevich's second trial, because the first trial, you know, there were so many counts thrown out, that Jackson was never really fully implicated by Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the case. But, you know, I come in Washington. Jackson fell under scrutiny by the House Ethics Committee for using staff resources in his lobbying campaign to be appointed to the Senate and that sorts of misconduct. In fact, that House probe was still underway and not concluded when Jackson, just after Thanksgiving, excuse me, the day before Thanksgiving last fall, resigned from his seat and acknowledged the federal investigation that came to fruition today.
Well, I suppose, though, just in terms of sort of stepping back and looking at the extraordinary politics of this whole sorry story, starting with Blagojevich and ending up with the sentencing today of Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife, there's a sense here that We've heard over the decades about political corruption, and of course the Republicans keep referring to Obama and the political machine in a derogatory way. But it does seem in many ways that that there's also this extraordinary element of personalities and rivalries, and Blagojevich screwing the Democrats and putting this Burris in, who was a complete disaster. It was almost like his way of telling, you know, giving them the finger, you know. So
Well, welcome to Chicago politics.
Is that it? Well, It certainly, as you pointed out, that it cost them a very important seat, and this is a Senate, as we all know, that hangs in the balance. And if they had a few more, I know that they lost the seat in Massachusetts. It cost them the possibility of avoiding filibusters, but it certainly would have helped to have somebody in there that could have won a re-election.
Having said that, I would just note that the Democrat who was up for the Senate seat in 2010 was not the most – he had some ethical challenges of his own. The Democrats
I remember that.
The Democrats didn't perhaps field their best candidate, and Mark Kirk prevailed. And we do have a history in Illinois of, you know, while much of greater Chicagoland is majority Democratic, the downstate regions of the state – that is to say, the collar counties of Chicago and the outlying regions are much more conservative, more Republican than the Cook County Democrats might have you believe, or the Cook County Democrats might exemplify, I should say.
So just one of the things that jumped out at me from your article, Catherine, is the idea of or the picture that you painted of them showing up, emerging from a white SUV, accompanied by Judy Smith, a crisis communication expert and former federal prosecutor whose work inspired the TV show Scandal.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, this is a bizarre show with this Kerry Washington who stars in it as this fixer in Washington, who also happens to be having an affair with the President of the United States on the side. It is, I guess, what they'd call adult soap opera. But describe this person then. If she inspired that character, boy, you could get some copy out of that.
Well, you know, the one thing that surprised me when I got to know a little bit about Judy Smith, let's say this, she's a crisis communications expert. And, of course, Hollywood is full of people like that. She helps people in trouble, trouble with the law, trouble with public relations disasters. But she is a former federal prosecutor in the same office that went up against the Jacksons, so she knows the law. And basically, she's brought on by the lawyers. I should say, I've probably never really spoken to her very much. I've spoken to her colleague a bit. But they're not necessarily there to, I mean, they're there to, I was talking to someone today, and I said, well, it's sort of concierge treatment for the defendants. And again, no disrespect meant for Judy Smith, but she's there to help them and guide them and be there for them at their side, at their ear, with this throng of, you know, 30 reporters and photographers, and run interference and protect them to the extent she can while they go through what's, let's face it, an incredibly traumatic experience. And I'm not sympathetic at all towards what the Jacksons did, and I don't mind saying that Jackson's 2nd Congressional District of Illinois was, you know, remapped over the years, and it took in the town where I grew up, my hometown, just outside the city of Chicago. I have sympathy for the people who were not represented by these two individuals while they were on spending sprees. But that said, you know, they have children, they are giving away their freedoms, and so, of course, I suppose there's any criminal sentencing I've covered, and I've covered many, you do feel a tinge of, you know, human sympathy at the downfall of two people who once held so much promise.
And, of course, the father, Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., was very much there today, and he's been carrying, obviously, the burden of this. And he addressed this idea of his son having a bipolar disorder. And, of course, there's been some cynicism and skepticism about how real that is. which he addressed. So do you think that he adequately addressed that suspicion that this was a convenient illness?
I'd say my colleague Marina Villanueva covered Reverend Jackson today, and Reverend Jackson has tried repeatedly to make the case that his son is a very, very sick person. It was June of 2012 that Jackson mysteriously took a leave from Congress. It was blamed on exhaustion. It emerged that he was at Sierra Tucson, a very high-end treatment facility in Arizona. Around the time of late July, he was moved to the Mayo Clinic. In fact, he was in and out of Mayo a couple of times. He actually won re-election last November while a patient at the Mayo Clinic. And I can tell you the government's response to that was a disappointment that there was not more of a factual basis for his mental condition put into the public record. Now, here reporters are a little bit handicapped because what was put into the record in many cases was redacted. But they had one expert saying he had bipolar disorder. They had another saying he had nonspecific mood disorder, probably bipolar. Today, an assistant prosecutor complaining said there is no there. And what he went on to say is that normally when mental health issues are litigated in a case like this, there's discovery, there's an examination of the defendant, there are medical records. And I can tell you the top prosecutor today, after the sentencings, this will be in my story in the Chicago Tribune tomorrow, pointed out that this years-long crime spree, much of that time, predated these two very noted stints in high-end treatment facilities. So I can tell you something the judge said. Sandy Jackson never represented any, mental infirmaries on her part. And the judge wondered, with this huge spending spree they'd been on, why nothing in the record suggested anything was ever returned to the stores where they were purchased. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, frankly, we'll ever really know, because of medical confidentiality reasons, where the absolute truth lies with that.
Right. Well, but clearly there's the skepticism will remain. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, Catherine Skiba.
Ian, thank you so much, and all the best.
All the best, and thank you for giving us a description of Chicago politics.
My pleasure. Call anytime.
Okay. Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Skiba, who's an award-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune. Previously, she was with the U.S. News & World Report and the Milwaukee Journal, and she's the author of a memoir based on the Iraq invasion, Sister in a Band of Brothers, Embedded with the 101st Airborne in Iraq. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.